Protests on college campuses are nothing new, but we seem to be in a period where that activism is having a greater impact. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll talk about the challenges colleges and universities are facing, the issues students are concerned about, and what we should expect from the protesters. Plus, Ann Romney has been in the public eye for decades, as her husband Mitt was governor of Massachusetts and the most recent Republican nominee for president. She's also had multiple sclerosis. We'll find out what she's doing to raise awareness and how the illness has affected her life. Also, Arizonan Sandra Day O'Connor became the first female in the history of the U.S. Supreme Court in 1981. She was joined by Ruth Bader Ginsburg 12 years later. A new book by Valley resident Linda Hirschman looks at the impact the two have had on justice in the U.S. and the respectful relationship they've had with each other. The book is called Sisters-in-Law. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, college campus protests have been happening across the country recently. We'll talk about whether we're seeing more of them and if they're more effective. And should traditionalists worry about what's happening to higher education? Also, Ann Romney, wife of 2012 Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney, will talk about the challenges of having multiple sclerosis and her efforts to find a cure for the illness. And we'll talk to the filmmaker who's recently produced a documentary about Valley chef Kevin Binkley. We start today's program by finding out what a former member of the Arizona Corporation Commission thinks about the current controversy surrounding the panel, including Attorney General Mark Brnovich calling for the state Supreme Court to remove Commission Chair Susan Bitter Smith from office. Bill Mundell served on the Corporation Commission from 2001 to 2008 and joins me now. Bill, good morning.
Morning, Steve.
So how concerned are you about the general perception of the commission right now?
Well, I think the people of Arizona have a right to be very concerned about the perception and the behavior of the commissioners and their cozy relationship with APS.
It just seems like it's snowballing. We certainly have earlier this week, as I mentioned, the Attorney General calling on the state Supreme Court to remove Bitter Smith from office. As you mentioned, Bob Burns even referenced this week this idea of, can we see what APS, in fact, has done? Have the commissioners done enough, Bill? When you were on the commission, if something like this had happened, would you have been bolder? Is it hard once you're in that position to be as bold as the public would like you to be?
Well, I would just state that when I was there, we had a fellow commissioner, Commissioner Irvin. Mm. We were all Republicans, and he had illegal activities going on, unethical behavior. And we asked him to resign. We couldn't force him to resign. And then when he didn't resign, we went to the legislature, and they started impeachment proceedings. So The commissioners can do a lot to clean their own house. And I would say, though, the AG's filing is a good first step in restoring the integrity at the commission. But the commissioners themselves have a lot of power and authority, and they could certainly do much more than they're doing. The request by Commissioner Burns is a good first step, but it doesn't go far enough because it doesn't request the disclosure of money spent by Pinnacle West, which is the holding company of APS. And so, yes, there's a lot more they could do. They each have the power to subpoena the books and records of not only APS, but also Pinnacle West.
Bill, I find it interesting. Over the years, many of us have talked about how the commission really hasn't gotten much attention, even as impactful as it is. Certainly, there was a lot of talk when the renewable energy standard came through. But other than that, we're just getting more about controversy these days. I sort of come back to the perception question. Does that make the commissioners less effective if controversy is sort of swirling and they're less worried about what I would think is a very complicated job?
Well, it certainly does. And I don't get credit for this, but a fellow commissioner once said that the commission is the most powerful institution in state government that most people have never heard of until recently. Now all this controversy, negative controversy, is swirling around it. So, yes, it makes it harder to do their job. The commissioners are quasi-judicial. They're like judges. They're supposed to avoid the appearance of impropriety. And with all this controversy and all these investigations swirling around them, it certainly has an impact on the public's perception of the commission. It's very sad, in my opinion.
How long did it take you to become good at this job? Because like I said, there's a lot of complexities there. There are many different issues to judge. And even with your background, I know if someone has a legal background, certainly they might have more affinity and more ability to figure this stuff out. But I guess what I'm saying is this, it seems like a lot of people go into this job almost thinking of it as a next step in a political career as opposed to realizing the issues that are involved. Do you think more thought needs to go into who's on the panel and what they know about what goes on the panel?
Well, certainly. I always said I was a much better commissioner in year eight than I was the first month I was there. But the big mistake that these commissioners have made and a lot of other people that run for the office is it's not the legislature. It's different. I served in the legislature also for 6 years. There are different rules. As I said earlier, the commissioners are like judges. They're supposed to avoid the appearance of impropriety and be fair to both sides. So, yes, it's one of the most powerful entities in state government. Law Review articles have said it's one of the most powerful commissions in the United States because it's in the state constitution, number one, and number two, the commissioners are elected. So the fact that it's in the state constitution means the legislature can't take away its authority. And number two, because they're elected, you don't serve at the pleasure of the governor. And so it's a very powerful position that our founding fathers put in the state constitution. It's considered a fourth branch of government, yeah. One of only seven states.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with former Arizona Corporation Commissioner Bill Mundell. Bill, let's come back to Commissioner Susan Bittersmith. You mentioned the Jim Irvin situation when you were on the panel. If asked for your advice, what would you advise Susan Bittersmith to do at this point? Should she resign? Should she just announce she's not running for re-election? What should she do?
I think for the good of the state and the good of the commission, she should immediately resign. Again, the AG filed a special action with the Supreme Court asking that she be removed. And this is a fellow Republican that did this. And so it doesn't appear to be political. It's based on the merits, and these are very serious allegations. I think for the good of the state and the good of the commission, she should immediately resign.
We just talked about how complex this job is, and Commissioner Bittersmith has maintained another full-time job. I think about when people start law school, they say there's no way you can actually do anything other than that first year other than go to law school and study for law school. How challenging would you find it to have a full-time job and also do your commission duties?
Well, it'd be very challenging. It's, again, as I said earlier, Steve, it's not the legislature. It's not a part-time position. You get paid almost $80,000 a year as a commissioner. It's a full-time job. And then she had this other job as the executive director of the Southwest Cable Communications Association, where she made over $150,000 a year. It's not a part-time job, like I said, the legislature or maybe mayor or city council or other elected positions. It's a full-time job, $80,000 a year, and the fact that she had another job in and of itself is pretty amazing.
And Commissioner Bittersmith has also mentioned how much she leans on her staff. And as I said, with, again, the complexities of this job, you must have some bureaucracy there. You must have some built-in institutional knowledge. But how much of it rests on what the commissioner, him or herself, has to be doing and has to know about the issues?
Well, there are certainly very talented staff individuals at the commission. But when I was there, and I didn't always agree with my fellow commissioners, but I can tell you they all worked very hard. They were there early in the morning and left late at night and just read and read and read, and you have your staff and you meet with them every day and go over the issues. And so it's a full-time position. And again, you get better at it each day you're there.
You know, I talked with a couple of skeptics, Bill, and they don't work for Commissioner Bittersmith, so it's not coming from there. It's just people in general who wonder. You mentioned the legislature. We hear about things. I think there are many people who, when it comes to politics, some people just shake their heads when it comes to money. Perhaps many of them are not even as concerned about the potential allegations of APS being involved in the last election cycle. Do you think what's going on is as clear-cut as Attorney General Brnovich does, as Attorney Tom Ryan does, as it relates to Susan Bittersmith, or is she being singled out?
Well, it's pretty clear-cut in my opinion, but ultimately the Arizona Supreme Court will decide if she has a conflict of interest. I would just go back to that kind of old-fashioned idea of how can you be an elected official and a lobbyist at the same time. I mean, the facts are the facts in the Susan Bittersmith case, and the Supreme Court will decide them. But the bigger picture is, again, how can you be a lobbyist and elected official at the same time? That's the perspective that I have.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. A couple more minutes left with former Arizona Corporation Commissioner Bill Mundell. Bill, a lot of major issues will come to the fore again early in 2016 when as it relates to the Corporation Commission. As we look at things like net metering, when we look at renewable energy standard, we look at where APS fits in on this, where solar providers fit in on this, how much does all of this make that even more complex? Is it going to make it harder for the commission to handle these issues in a way that voters would expect?
Well, yes, it'll make it much more difficult when all these allegations are swirling around. And as I said, you have these other investigations going on. You have the allegations of the dark money, the secret money being spent, $3.2 million by APS to get two of the commissioners elected. And then more importantly is the fact that there's been allegations that the chairman, former chairman of the commission, coordinated the campaign with the secret money to get them elected. That remains to be seen. That's an ongoing investigation. So it's always difficult to do your job when you have all these allegations and investigations going on.
Should future Corporation Commission candidates, and if you were to run again, if you were to someone to get involved again, should Corporation Commission candidates say they will not take any money from APS, from anyone else? And if, in fact, there's any possibility that APS has been involved in that, then they would reject those funds?
Well, they certainly shouldn't take any money from the utilities they regulate. As a democracy, we can't have, you know, the utilities funding and electing the commissioners that regulate them. I can tell you in the old days, this would have never happened at APS under the prior executives. It was a fireable offense if any employee at APS got elected in a commission race. It's changed recently, but you certainly shouldn't take money from the utilities that you're regulating.
Is APS sort of running wild then, Bill?
Well, they've certainly changed. The policy has certainly changed under the current administration. Like I said, for years, it was a fireable offense for any employee from the top CEO down to the alignment, you know, out there putting up wires for us, transmission lines, to participate in a election for the commission. So it's certainly changed.
Bill Mundell served on the Arizona Corporation Commission from 2001 to 2008. Bill, thanks for the time.
Thanks for having me.
And still to come on Here and Now, we'll look at college campus protests, and we'll hear from Ann Romney, wife of the 2012 Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney, about her fight with multiple sclerosis. Stay with us.
KJZZ is supported by Pita Jungle, a locally owned restaurant offering holiday catering with vegetarian and vegan options. You can give the gift of eating healthy with Pita Jungle gift cards. More at PitaJungle.com.
You are listening to Here and Now on KJZZ. Taking a look at Valley traffic right now, eastbound on the Loop 202 Red Mountain Freeway, there's a collision blocking the shoulder at Van Buren Street. Sunshine across the state at this hour. It's 42 degrees in Flagstaff, 44 in Prescott, 54 in Casa Grande, it's 56 in Tucson, and 62 in Yuma. If you've got an unwanted car in your driveway, there's still time to donate it to KJZZ and get a 2015 tax deduction. Just donate it before December 31st. We'll tow it away for free, and we'll turn your car into the programs you love. To donate a vehicle, go to cars.kjzz.org, and thanks. Fair skies right now over Phoenix, 57 degrees at 11:19.
College campus protests have been happening across the country recently. The one that received the most national attention was at the University of Missouri, where a hunger strike and threats by the football team to forfeit games led to the school president resigning. Protesters were frustrated by what they deemed a racially insensitive environment. Other public issues have come up in colleges and universities like Yale and Occidental. So are we seeing more protests? Are they more effective? And should traditionalists worry about what's happening to higher education? Joining me for a few minutes to talk about those concepts is John Warner, who writes the Just Visiting blog for Inside Higher Ed and is also a visiting instructor at the College of Charleston. Hi, John.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good to have you with us. So you've written that the best way to deal with student protest is to both encourage it and take it seriously. What should our general expectations be when it comes to student protesters and at the same time the administration?
Well, the reason I say take it seriously is because these are students who are engaging with serious issues. So when they make demands or requests of the community that they are part of that they think needs to change in order to thrive, they should be listened to, and they should be dealt with in the same way anyone else would be. One of the criticisms you hear thrown around administration is that they are too quick to, quote unquote, cave to these demands. And I would say if that's the case, that's the administration's problem, that they shouldn't indeed cave if they think the demands are unreasonable, that students should be engaged as any other constituent that's part of the community would. And we discuss and debate and try to look for a collaborative solution.
And this is going to be a very blanket question here. I'm wondering what you think, though, in general, because some of those critics will also say that some of the protesters are not realistic, that they'll get in there and there are certain things they're concerned about, and they're looking to topple an administration as opposed to necessarily making the situation better. Because I do wonder, when you then replace a new administration with, you replace someone with a new administrator, is that person going to be softer? Is that person going to end up being even harder edged to make sure it doesn't happen to me, what happened to the previous administrator?
Sure. These are definitely concerns, and I think we have to be careful about, I don't know about the frame of realistic. Realistic gets into debates of what can or cannot be done, when I really think these debates should be happening at the level of values, that is, values like inclusiveness and community. Realistic tends to be a criticism of specific demands, and if those demands are not realistic or impossible, students need to be told that. I think in the case of Missouri, which really is the you know, predominant case when we're looking at an administration being toppled, one of the things a lot of people are missing out on is that Missouri had a considerably more complicated situation going on than is widely reported. In fact, the Chronicle of Higher Education last week or the week before reported about how the deans, collective deans of the university, have been plotting, this is their quote, plotting to get rid of the chancellor. So this was a community that had been in the midst of a crisis for quite some time, a community that did not think their leadership was serving them well. And it came to a head quite quickly, and the football team involving themselves obviously brought it to this sort of crisis point. But there were a lot of underlying issues going on there. It wasn't just a matter of a football team demanding leadership step down. It was a very broad loss of confidence amongst the community. And I think that's why you saw those figures resign pretty quickly once it did come to a head.
John, how much do current protests have to do with racism or perceived racism? And I also wonder whether administrations are simply not equipped, for whatever reason, to deal with more racial diversity on campuses.
I think it can depend on the institution, but I think clearly at places like Missouri and what we've seen at Yale, that students and many faculty perceive a climate that is not hospitable to minority students. I think there is a certain emboldening of those movements as you see it at different colleges, and you think, yes, we can do this here too. This is getting action. I think it's also strongly related to a kind of general climate of anxiety that exists on our campuses, where it seems like there's less room for error as college gets more expensive, as the necessity of a degree seems to climb higher and higher each year. So I think what you're seeing is a lot of generalized tension and anxiety that manifests itself or maybe amplifies some of these larger, long-standing cultural problems inside these institutions.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. A few more minutes left with John Warner, who writes the Just Visiting blog for Inside Higher Ed, is also a visiting instructor at the College of Charleston. John, what's the impact of social media and the 24-hour news cycle on the impact on what happens with these protests, the fact that the protests have maybe more staying power and maybe even some sort of legacy attached to them as well?
Well, for sure, the word can spread much faster, much more quickly. Information can be shared. One of the things you can see now is there's websites that are sort of a clearinghouse of the different demands on different campuses protesters have made. So I think there's a definite kind of information sharing aspect to this. I also think that it creates a certain amplification of these things in the political realm, where we're now having a debate about the debate, where people like me who are not involved directly in the community at Missouri and Yale have opinions about how these things fit in. And so where we see, what distresses me is when we see what are community issues primarily at Missouri and Yale that are reflective of issues other communities are having become kind of political footballs, where we start to decry a kind of new PC or liberalism or this kind of stuff. The reality is this sort of thing is not happening on the vast majority of campuses. Most students are doing what students have always wanted to do, is come and learn and grow and get a degree and prosper as citizens. So I think the effect of social media sometimes is to amplify all voices in a way that sometimes makes the loudest or the most strident seem to substitute for all voices. But I think it's always more complicated and diverse than we might get in those media.
So, John, do you see examples of seeing more students who are willing to protest and maybe sacrifice something? Like, again, we think about the Missouri football game, a Missouri football team thinking about forfeiting games. Are more students willing to miss classes to stand up for something they believe in? What you just said, are we seeing some more of the louder activists sort of taking the spotlight at this point?
I think there is definitely a growing awareness on campuses of the power that students can wield if they act. And act collectively. I think that is new. Even at my home institution, we have had protests over various things in the last few years, which were really just students voicing their concerns about the community and exercising their First Amendment rights as any other citizen. So I do think there is an awareness that they need to self-advocate, that they need to involve themselves in the community, and protest is one of those tools that is open to them. And this is why I encourage it. My goal for students is that they become healthy, productive, well-informed citizens of their own minds, and protest is a great way to practice that.
And John, briefly, less than a minute or so, but one of the things you wrote, which I think is quite interesting the way you phrased it too, the Republic will indeed stand, and the history of student protests, our present examples are rather tame. Can you dig into that a little bit for a few seconds?
Well, I mean, if we look at you know, the 60s or something like that, and while I'm not quite old enough to go back that far, there was much greater campus upheaval. If you see sort of the student movements at UC Berkeley in the 60s, where there really was a fight for the souls of these universities, I don't really think we're there. I think there's a lot of agreement on what universities should do and stand for. I think what we see now is a group of people that feel that the universities have not allowed them to be part of that community, and that they should be invited in and indeed given a seat at the table. So I find this is only encouraging.
John Warner writes the Just Visiting blog for Inside Higher Ed. He's also a visiting instructor at the College of Charleston. John, thanks very much for the time.
My pleasure.
You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Ann Romney has been in the public eye for decades. Her husband, Mitt, has been governor of Massachusetts and was in charge of the 2002 Salt Lake City Olympic Games. And more recently, he was the 2012 Republican presidential nominee. Through all of those periods, Ann Romney was suffering from multiple sclerosis. In her new book, In This Together, Romney writes about getting diagnosed, her treatment, and efforts to find a cure, and all of the proceeds from the book will go toward research to find a cure. Ann Romney joins me now. What were your initial symptoms?
They're pretty common, I think, for people that suffer from multiple sclerosis. One was numbness in my leg. I mean, it can come in different places, and some people get it in their eyes, which is really, I mean, you know right away something's really wrong if all of a sudden you wake up and you can't see. And that's optic neuritis that sometimes happens. But for me, it was my right leg was numb. And it had happened the year before in sort of the inner part of around my knee. And I didn't, when it first happened, I thought, isn't that interesting? I probably have a pinched nerve. And I didn't give it a second thought. And then it went over months. I didn't even notice coming and going really because it wasn't that dramatic. And then the next year, it came back, but when it came back, it was bigger, more noticeable and at the same time enormous fatigue, and then a loss of balance and, you know, stumbling. And then I started noticing that I was even stumbling with thoughts or being able to communicate. Like, I couldn't quite get my words out. And that's when I knew there was something really wrong with me, but I had not a clue what it was. Not a clue.
Now, the first medical professional you saw was your brother, is
my,
that right?
My brother on the phone. And, you know, after about 6 weeks of this, I knew that it wasn't going away. And I called him, and he listened, and he instantly told me to go see a neurologist. And I thought, well, why would I do that? Mm-hmm. But I really didn't know where to go. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know the first step I should take. You don't go, and it's, where's the doctor that I don't feel good? You know, but I don't feel right. But I knew, like, a regular, just general practitioner wasn't going to say, yeah, you have something. And yet I was really mystifying, because I'm like, well, I'm not having a heart attack, and I'm not having a stroke, and I'm not, I mean, you start going through all these things, and is it diabetes? I mean, like, even diabetes, everything. I started wondering, do I have this? Do I have that? I had no clue what I had.
And then you mention in the book that you're sitting in the lobby of the neurologist and seeing all these pamphlets and trying to figure out which symptoms sort of align with what I've got.
And I narrowed it to ALS and MS. Mm-hmm. Lou Gehrig's.
Scary initials either way, yeah.
And multiple sclerosis. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, I know I've got one of those two. And, you know, I'm very thrilled now with the Ann Romney Center for Neurologic Disease that we are studying ALS, and that honestly we have in our laboratory a drug that is working and effective on animal studies. It's so exciting that we're fast tracking it. It is being compounded right now, and it will be ready for human trials in 2017. Mm.
In the Phoenix area, we have this strange illness called Valley Fever, which is really only seen here and in some of the Inland Empire in California. And I've talked to doctors about it, and they will almost say, and I think they say this in a way where they feel strange saying it, but it almost takes a high-profile person to have an illness in order to really get momentum going to try to find a cure for it or try to find a treatment for it. And I wonder, with your center and what you've been through, I know you don't want to be seen as some sort of guinea pig, but do you think it helps to have someone as high profile and dedicated as you are to maybe make some big strides in something like this?
Yes and no. I mean, I was very hesitant to put my name on the center, mm-hmm. because I feel like, you know, from my faith perspective, you do things, good works in secret, or you are quiet and you have humility about that. And for me to put my name on something was totally went against my sensibilities. But I had a lot of encouragement from the doctors at Brigham and Women's and from other people that said, this will be more powerful and more impactful if you do it. And I kept saying, well, why don't we let somebody that's going to donate a lot of money have their name on it? And that's more sort of the model. Mm-hmm. And now that I see, it's been a year since we've announced the center and we've been going, I now see that it actually has made a huge difference, that I can open doors, that I can get media exposure, that I can write a book and it can become a New York Times bestselling book. Mm-hmm. You know, those things that I would never have guessed. I did not see that myself as having any kind of an impact.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Ann Romney, the author of the book In This Together. She'll be signing books tonight at 5:30 at Deseret Books in Gilbert. Mrs. Romney, let's talk a little bit about the treatment that you've gone through. Your diagnosis was almost a couple of decades ago, so it's mm-hmm. been a number of years. Can you give us some idea of how the treatment started and what changed about it, and what has made things more effective for you?
Yeah, you know, initially my diagnosis, and it was somewhat common during that time, was you're diagnosed and you're sent home. And that is obviously the case with ALS still. But with MS, that's not the case anymore. But for me, it was. And for that first month, 2 months, I progressed very rapidly. And then I was pushed to go to another neurologist, which I did. And he is now the co-head of my center, Dr. Howard Weiner. And he recognized in his studying of the disease for 25 years at that point that it was important when you're first diagnosed to be very aggressive in your treatment. The thought before was, well, wait till you're really bad, then we'll treat. So he, in my first visit, took me and put me in treatment right away, like that minute. He had his evaluation, his testing, and then he took me by my hand and he walked me down the hall and sat me in an infusion chair. And I was treated aggressively with intravenous steroids. And for me, I was very, very lucky to have had Howard Weiner in my life at that point, because now we do know early intervention is very important. And the steroids either work or they don't. And he said that. He said, we're going to know pretty quickly whether this is effective or not. Now, the second piece of that that was troubling for me was, yes, it worked. It stopped the progression of the numbness and the weakness and where it was literally eating away my nerves. But it did not make me feel better. And so that piece was something that Western medicine at that point was like, really, that's as much as we can tell you now. You can still have a life. You can still go on. But I'm like, what kind of a life if I can't even get out of bed? I discovered accidentally things that helped me, horseback riding, acupuncture, reflexology, things like that, which I thought were total woohooey nonsense things that I now recognize help stimulate nerves, help promote the movement of energy throughout your body. And I needed to add that second layer to make myself have more energy just to get through the day. And that took me, honestly, it took me years, about 3 years of very aggressive work.
Considering all the things you've done, you have raised 5 kids, you had a husband who was governor, he ran the Olympics. Does anything compare with having a presidential campaign and being involved in that? Because especially when you are dealing with the illness you were dealing with, did you find that an additional challenge?
Yeah, it was. And, you know, I had to be honest. And I had great help and great support system, which knew that I could go for 3 days and then I'd have to have a couple of days off. I couldn't go like Mitt could. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he has enormous energy. And Mitt was the best person that understood that, too, because he was always calling, you know, anyone that was working with me and saying, take it easy, give her more rest. And I would be doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. I would call and say, don't work him so hard. You know, when he doesn't even have time to do a bathroom break, it's like, come on, guys, this is ridiculous. You know, it is that intense. People have no idea like how intense a presidential is. You don't have a moment to yourself. Nor you don't really have a moment to understand all the incoming as well. You couldn't possibly be reading all the articles. You couldn't possibly be watching the television. You are the one that's doing the performing, but it's kind of fascinating. You don't have like a good perspective when you're in the middle of it. You're just in fight mode, and that's tiring.
Okay. Oh, terrific. Okay. Would you mind giving me the best part of presidential campaign and the worst?
The best part are the people. And, you know, you go to especially Iowa, New Hampshire, where it's really hands-on and you really get to see what's going on and you're in people's living rooms and you're talking to people and you're finding out what they're thinking about and you find out what they care about and I loved it. I met women that were like loving their families but worried about jobs. They want to raise a family. They're the real issues, real people. And if that's what politics is really about, is trying to make people's lives better. And if you don't know who they are, how can you possibly really, truly care? And that's the best part. The toughest part, obviously, is the media part, which is, you know, a lot of what obviously every single candidate thinks, no matter which party you're in, it's unfair. I mean, you know, I guess if it's unfair across the board, that's okay. I loved Mitt's attitude about that, though. He was always like, look, they're just doing their job. I mean, he was never like, oh, I can't believe this. He was like, they're doing their job, how they think they want to do their job. That's their job. My job is to try to communicate better what I feel like a frustration. And so I loved his attitude. He never took it personally. It was great.
Was there ever consideration of running in 2016 like the rumors said?
Oh, yeah. I mean, last January for 20 seconds, we thought about it. We put our toe in for 20 seconds and we're like, nope. We did that. It's done.
Ann Romney is the author of In This Together, and she's going to be signing books at 5:30 p.m. tonight at Gilbert's Deseret Books. Thank you so much. Great to meet you.
Thank you.
And still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk with author Linda Hirschman about her new book, about Justices Sandra Day O'Connor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And then later this hour, we'll meet the filmmaker behind a new documentary about Phoenix chef Kevin Binkley. Stay with us.
KJZZ is supported by Wells Fargo on behalf of St. Vincent de Paul, continuing to feed, clothe, house, and heal struggling families and individuals in need. Your gift may qualify for a credit on your Arizona tax return. Info at stvincentdepaul.net.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. Well, should be a very pleasant day today in the valley. Forecast calling for sunny skies, a high near 70 degrees. Clear overnight, going to get pretty chilly though. Lows dropping down into the low 40s and about the same for the next couple of days. Sunny, highs of 76 tomorrow and 74 on Friday. Stay with us for NPR's Here and Now at 12 o'clock. The British Parliament is debating whether or not to authorize airstrikes in Syria. And Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg has announced he's giving $45 billion, that's billion with a B, to charity to support education. Here and Now from Boston starts at noon. Right now in Phoenix under fair skies, it's 57 degrees at 11:41.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Valley resident Sandra Day O'Connor became the first female justice in the history of the U.S. Supreme Court when Ronald Reagan selected her and the Senate approved the nomination in 1981. Justice O'Connor remained the sole female on the High Court until Ruth Bader Ginsburg joined her in August of 1993. In the new book, Sisters-in-Law, author Linda Hirschman writes about the impact Justices O'Connor and Ginsburg have had on the legal system and, in turn, the entire nation. She also writes about the mutual respect the two had for each other, even as they weren't social friends. Now, Linda, looking back, did Justice O'Connor's approach and the perception of her as a non-ideologue who worked well with others make it possible for Justice Ginsburg to make it on the court?
Yes, I absolutely believe that Sandra Day O'Connor, for many reasons, made it easier for Ruth Bader Ginsburg to follow her.
Certainly Sandra Day O'Connor is not a mild-mannered person, but she did, but she does come across, I think, as someone who's, I think people have a perception of her that maybe she is a little bit more staid, perhaps, than she really is, but was that something that played into it, or was it the way she performed as a justice that made it more possible for Justice Ginsburg?
It's more the former than the latter. It's so wonderful to be interviewed by someone who comes from Arizona and knows the real story, because she has a public image of being a rather more conventional person and player and thinker than she really is. But I think that her gift for getting along with more powerful men, which was extraordinary, and her ironclad self-discipline so that she made no demands and she caused no trouble, made it much easier for the next woman to be second. Her history in politics in Arizona was a gift to the court and helped the court, because they didn't have very many practicing politicians among their numbers at any time when she was on there, and I think she brought some wisdom that the court benefited from. It's even arguable that having the first woman be a Republican who was constantly finessing the line between her party's increasing conservatism on the issue of women and her role as a representative of women on the court helped, so that she was tacking, and it made a space for the person who was sailing more directly into the wind to follow her.
For those who maybe didn't realize how intelligent and how, frankly, how tough she is as far as being strong-willed, so was there a surprise later on that she became so impactful, even to people who don't follow the court that much, and they would say, oh, it's quote-unquote the O'Connor court, because she had so much impact because she was able to perhaps influence some of her colleagues?
So she had the advantage of having an incremental case-by-case jurisprudence, which enabled her to avoid predictability. So she became the desirable swing vote after Powell left in 1987. She became the desirable swing vote in part because her jurisprudence was not ideologically and fixed in a partisan way as hard as her colleagues were. So part of it's just politics, her belief system and her thinking about how the society should be governed was more in the middle between the two camps on the court. It could have been a man or someone with a very different character. If they had that belief system, it would have put them in the middle. It was Powell before it was O'Connor, and it was Kennedy after it was O'Connor. So part of it is just happenstance in that way. But she was extraordinarily skilled and tough-minded about wielding the power that that brought her. So that, for instance, she would hold off agreeing to join an opinion that was circulating in order to make the opinion writers move heaven and earth to capture her critical fifth vote. She would wait to let them know whether they had her or not. She would bargain for what she wanted in the opinions by threatening to concur. And if you're the critical fifth vote and you concur, then that means that you're the only vote. Because the four justices that agree are not a majority. She would use that very skillfully, and sometimes she would threaten to go over to the other side.
In the book, you write about one particular decision and opinion that really seemed to illustrate a connection between Justices O'Connor and Ginsburg that was especially vital for Justice Ginsburg.
Her landmark decision is something called United States versus Virginia, the VMI, the Virginia Military Institute case. She only got to write that opinion because O'Connor had said, "Don't give that to me. That should be Ruth's." So it was a real act of sisterhood that O'Connor did that.
I would like you to describe in the book as well what you say about when Justice Ginsburg was reading her opinion.
Right. So Ginsburg got to write the opinion. We now know. We did not know at the time. We now know because of what O'Connor did. And on opinion day, the judges who write the opinions get to read a little bit of them out loud in court. And Ginsburg was reading a little bit of the VMI decision, which is quite a long decision, in court. And in the part she chose to read, she included a reference to Justice O'Connor's decision in a sex discrimination case from 15 years before, when O'Connor first went on the court. I always think that people who doubt O'Connor's deep feminist credentials should think she just arrived on the court in 1981, and she was the swing vote, the decisive fifth vote in a very important sex discrimination case. So Ginsburg cites that case, it's called Hogan, and then she stops, and she Ginsburg, who's not very demonstrative, lifts her eyes from the papers that she's reading from and looks directly across the bench at Sandra Day O'Connor and nods. And there's a moment when they both acknowledged the legacy that they had been building together, and then Ginsburg went back to reading the rest of the excerpt from her decision. It's a beautiful moment, and I think that small bits of evidence like that reflect that these two women had a very high regard for each other, because underneath their superficial differences, they were actually profoundly similar.
Has their impact made it so more women want to get into that profession and the more women are able to get into the profession?
O'Connor's impact, which is very, very, very big, is that she showed that a woman could attain the highest level of the profession. And it's just like the election of Barack Obama. It gave everybody below her hope that the gates were not forever closed to them because of their gender. There was a time when she was the most famous woman in the world, and people, you couldn't walk down the block with her and not sign 1,000 autographs and stuff. Ginsburg actually really opened the gates. I mean, she made it legally possible for women to demand to be treated equally, so that in the most graphic way, there was a case from the 19th century where the Supreme Court had said that a state could say that women weren't allowed to become lawyers. That case was still good law when Ruth Bader Ginsburg stood up to argue her first case, or to brief her first case in the Supreme Court in 1971. So Ruth Bader Ginsburg actually got the court to apply the Equal Protection Clause to women and made it illegal for states to keep them from practicing law. So that's an enormous accomplishment.
Linda Hirschman is the author of Sisters in Law, How Sandra Day O'Connor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg Went to the Supreme Court and Changed the World. Linda is a New York City and a Phoenix resident. Linda, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you so much for having me on my home NPR station.
I originally spoke with Linda Hirschman in September. She'll be at Changing Hands Bookstore in Phoenix tonight at 7 to talk about Sisters in Law. This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. In recent years, the Valley has developed a reputation for interesting chefs trying unique recipes with intriguing combinations. And their restaurants aren't limited to Uptown Phoenix or Scottsdale. One chef who's received a lot of praise from patrons and critics is Kevin Binkley, whose original Binkley's is located in Cave Creek. Filmmaker Andrew Gooey learned about Binkley's inspirations and passion and put them in his new documentary, which is called Binkley's, and Andrew joins me now. Andrew, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So what makes Kevin Binkley successful based on what you saw as a filmmaker?
Well, just straight off the bat, I think it's passion, and then it's obsession. And then I just think with that combined together, you just get great dishes, and just what he's trying to do is just, it's very rare. And I love being able to see what he does, and being able to film that has been quite an experience.
Now, it was a positive portrayal, but as you mentioned, someone who's obsessed with his craft like this, how did you work around that? I'm guessing he was cool with you being there, but at the same time, what are some workarounds you guys had to figure out?
Well, there wasn't a whole lot of workarounds. He definitely, he mentions that I'm like a stodge in his restaurant. And so with what he has to do every night, focusing on service and focusing on these dishes, I think it was pretty easy to not have to cater to me. But we had this thing where I told him and his staff, like, don't worry about me. I'm just going to try to be the fly on the wall in his restaurant. And you just do your thing and let me film you. And so...
How many days, how many times did you go to the restaurant?
We filmed over a period of 5 months, and, you know, some weeks will go twice, some weeks will go once, and so, yeah, we had to work around different travel schedules as well.
How much material did you end up having? I mean, it's about a 25-minute documentary?
Yeah, about 25 minutes. I would say we had about close to 72 hours of footage, yeah.
Okay. So how much of that came down to you reshooting something that you wanted better, and how much of it was, I mean... There's always that eureka moment with an artist with what you're doing. I'm sure Kevin has that. You must have had that too. When you have that many hours of footage, though, was it more difficult? Or when you went along, were you able to say, I kind of think this is going to have to be in the final product?
You know, I had a certain idea of how the film was going to go. And then it was a very defining moment. Kevin had a chef's dinner that he put together with a small group of people in the bakery section of Binkley's. And with these people, him and his two chefs, they basically cooked for these folks. And at that dinner, I really, really saw the knowledge, the experience, and the care that went into all the ingredients. And that became how I edited the film. You know, it's almost you watched Kevin speak to you about his dishes, and in between, you learned about his life a little bit more.
Did the fly on the wall thing work? Were people able to forget you were there?
With Kevin and his chefs, they were basically so busy, you know, they didn't notice I was there. I think the people in the service staff had ducked a couple of times, and I had to tell them, stop ducking, you know, and if I got lower my camera, you can't duck anymore after that. And so, yeah, but they were amazing, very generous, gracious people.
One thing I found interesting about the film is that he came to the Valley for a totally different reason. He was going to be a student at ASU. I can't recall what his major was going to be.
It was music, yeah.
Okay, and then someone told him about the Scottsdale Culinary Institute. Mm-hmm. And then he just, how did he know, based on what you've talked to him about, that was the right path for him? Because clearly it has been.
Sure, yeah, and there's this one part in the film where he says that, you know, to prep in the morning and have to cook what you prepped in the afternoon didn't seem like work. Didn't, you know, it seemed like some sort of day camp in school. And so I think, you know, from what we've gathered from him, that was his interest into food.
So what has changed about him as a chef, as he's become more influential, more powerful, certainly he's extremely successful. Did he talk with you about what changed from the time he was 20 years old to now? Is he a much more confident person, or does he still have that little bit of doubt in what he's doing?
You know, I'll definitely say the confidence is there, you know, and but not knowing Chef Binkley in previous years, I can't really speak to that. But I will say that from our filming, we just learned that the restaurant business is as difficult today as it was before, and he's just incredibly hardworking and just works hard at it.
Now, when you think about going in there as a filmmaker, mm-hmm. one thing that I people will, when they write a book about someone or they make a film, there's always that tendency to really start to relate so much to your subject and even really like your subject. Now, again, in this case, it was okay to have a positive spin on him, but was there a feeling that you didn't want to get to feel too much like, oh my gosh, this is the greatest restaurateur I've ever met or something like that? Did you want to still keep that distance a little bit?
Yeah, you know, I feel like Kevin's, this part of our story with Kevin is definitely not the end. You know, we've been sharing with a lot of people that this is going to be at least 2 to 3 years of a documentary. So we're going to continue to learn more about him, continue to share his story through each year. And, you know, we've definitely seen, times of stress and, you know, really good times. And we'd love to incorporate more of that, as we progress with the film.
What's your favorite style of shooting? And is there a particular scene in this film that when you saw it later, you're really especially excited about?
You know, there's my style is very handheld documentary type style. Mm-hmm. It makes the audience feel like you're sitting in there. One of my favorite scenes in the film is towards the end with former Arizona Republic food critic Howie Saftel, and how he was talking about how he was looking through all these years of
newspaper clippings
of Binkley's, and that was fascinating. I wanted to take the audience right into that moment and sit right beside him, and that was very defining for me.
How important do you think it is to have celebrity chefs, let's say what Kevin Binkley is, in order to get the Valley restaurant scene even more out there? As I mentioned, it's developing a really good reputation. But do you think, as a filmmaker and someone who's been involved with food, do you think it's important to have those sort of pinpoint people to look at?
Absolutely. Chef Binkley is a mentor to many people, is an inspiration to many people. I don't know if celebrity is something that he's going for, but, you know, he continues to work hard ever since the first day of Binkley's and until today. You know, he's continued to work hard, and I think that makes a great difference. It inspires a lot of the younger chefs to push hard and not go for the fame, but go for the food, the good food.
Well, I was wondering, Ed, do you think he has coattails? I mean, are there people that, does he have a style, I don't want to say that can be mimicked, but in a sense, is there a certain style that he has that people can say, I can sort of strive to be not as successful, but to prepare food, serve food in that way?
I think it's knowledge is his absolute strength. Chef Binkley is an absolutely brilliant man, very intelligent man. If you sit him down and you just talk about ingredients and talk about where things are sourced from, what's the best time of year for different ingredients, that he can just spill out all of that. It's a science. You know, I think he's really more like a scientist. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, is that someone, when you're that talented, there's got to be, I mean, as much as you got along with him, did you see a different side of him? Did you see that intense sort of temperamental side at any point?
Chef Binkley is very calm. I was kind of hoping for certain scenes where I'm like, oh my gosh, I wonder if this is going to be, if we will see an explosive side of Chef Binkley. But Chef Binkley has remained calm through most of it. There are times, of course, you know, when things got stressful, and, you know, I saw how he, he spoke, you know, if he had to correct someone on his team, he definitely did it with a lot of professionalism. You know, it wasn't explosive. It wasn't, you know, at all in any way unprofessional.
So it's about 25 minutes, as we said. Mm-hmm. You're working on making it longer. So if people want to see this version of it, though, are there going to be opportunities?
Absolutely. We just secured our screening. Next screening time, it's going to be January 6th on a Wednesday. It's going to be at Binks Midtown, uh-huh. and it'll be limited seating. Two screenings, one at 5:30 and one at 8 p.m., and I hear Chef Binkley's going to put a special menu together.
Andrew Gooey is the filmmaker behind the new documentary. It's called Binkley's, which is about Kevin Binkley. the chef who was originally based in Cave Creek. Great to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Steve. Appreciate it.
Thanks very much to our senior producer, Sarah Ventry, and Bruce Drummond for their help on today's program. Thank you very much for listening. If you missed any part of the program, you can go online later this afternoon to kjzz.org. You can also download the KJZZ app. It's free to your smartphone to catch all of our past and future programs. NPR's Here and Now is next on member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great rest of the day. It's 12 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Mountain States Employers Council, providing businesses with HR support and employment law assistance, focusing on critical matters such as hiring and firing, workplace harassment, and the Affordable Care Act, msec.org.